You're in with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dolores Cahill Show on TNTRadio.live. That's how you'll find us. And my guests this morning, I'm very honored, including many of them, like me, are supporting and involved in the World Council for Health. Dr. Jennifer Hibbert, Dr. Kat Lindley, and James Roguski, and Michael Alexander. So, Dr. Jennifer Hibbert, we're very welcome to go back to you now. If you just wanted to give us, again, some details on the World Council for Health and what your activities are. Welcome.
Thank you. It'd be a pleasure doing that. The World Council for Health, we formed the World Council for Health in September of 2021. And I would like to explain what it is. It's a collaboration of alliances from around the world. And we come together at the World Council to work together to find a better way for humanity. And we have over 50 countries represented. We have about 120 different alliances that are part of the World Council. We have a General Assembly meeting every Monday where we discuss topics that are important to share with the world. We live stream. Our values are most importantly transparency, so that people can easily see how we work, watch our meetings, see our resources on our website, and know where we spend our money and where it comes from. And it is totally based on donations, and we are not for profit at all. So we also, our values is to provide education, increase knowledge about health issues, educate the public, and internally to make sure we know what we're all doing and get to the bottom of emerging health issues and share that knowledge not only amongst our members and our alliances, but to bring it out to the public in a way that they can understand. Because we all go into scientific meetings and speak, and it has a language all of its own. And certainly sometimes our scientists that come on board to talk, and they're phenomenal, slip into a very scientific discussion. So it's for us to unravel that for the public and bring it to our platform and bring it out to the public. And we're on so many social media platforms right now too. Of course, a lot of alternative media platforms to help them. We want to help people have ownership and personal responsibility for their health. And with that, we believe, of course, in informed consent and freedom of choice. People should be able to make their own decisions about their bodies and be free from coercion. So this was an important reason for us to come together, too, to help people understand what their choices may be. We are value, of course, we value evidence-based medicine and science, and we stand by that. And we want to help people to have self-care and wellness so that they can take care of themselves and others with simple, natural approaches to health so that we help them stay strong in body, mind, and relations and avoid the dependence on third parties or medications. And having said that, of course, there is a place for medications and there is a place for having to go into certain systems of care. But we want people to see a much broader spectrum of what is available to them in this world for health. So I'd like
That's wonderful, Jennifer. And a lot of the web pages as well is the worldcouncilforhealth.org.
Yes, thank you very much. And I would like to introduce Kat Lindley, who is a steering committee member with me on the World Council. And she will go into more information for everybody about what we do in the World Council and what we provide. Thanks, Kat.
Thank you. So I joined World Council early on this year. I followed them for a while. And there is such a value in this resource because a lot of people right now are confused with what's happening. We are seeing a lot of people who have had adverse effects to these experimental vaccines. And there is a great guide that everyone likes to download, which is, how to detoxify. I don't necessarily think that you can detoxify 100%, but what I do feel is that our guide is very powerful in helping the immune system regain its function, because that's what happens. Your immune system gets a little bit overwhelmed with what's going on with these boosters and things like that. And there's so many resources on, which coalitions and partners to even find in your own country that can help you. And like Jennifer said, we talk about different treatments, different options. And in the world that's getting more confusing by a minute, it's a place for people to come together. And that's why I like
it. And Kat, you were mentioning as well about Nobel Prize winning vitamin D. So some of the ways to improve your immune system and be healthy are actually very simple and straightforward.
Yes, and it was my honor to be one of your first guests when you had your first show. And we talked about
Thank you,
a lot. Thank you. We talked about that. You know, we can do so much at home, just even with the foods we eat, the things we drink, but there's so many vitamins. Vitamin D is essential. Essential. I can't say how important. Dr. Ryan Cole is a friend that he always talks about vitamin D, vitamin D. But there's also vitamin C and N-acetylcysteine and zinc and black seed oil. And there's so, and even turmeric, you can cook with these things, that ginger. There's so much we can do at home. And then when you need to, there are therapeutics that we'll talk about later on and how important they are.
Because I know your medical practice in a way, Kat, I think your practice, I've looked up your website, it's amazing. It's kind of a model for how people can really be healthy, which means symptoms free, right?
Yes, I really think to go forward, to have a better future, better way, as we like to say in World Council, we need to rethink medicine. Because in my opinion, medicine starts with you, not with me. You are your own healer. I'm just your guide along the way and to show you how to do things. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm just here to show you the way. And I think if everyone takes ownership of their own health, of their own lives, this will be a better place for all of us.
And you know, in Chinese medicine over thousands of years, I think it's very simple. They would pay their medical professional for as long as they were symptom-free. And then if they got a symptom, they wouldn't pay them until the symptom went away. I think it's very elegant, right?
I love that. You know? I love that.
Yeah. And that obviously is established over thousands of years and it resonates. And in a way, your practice, Kat, is very similar to that, that you're on call for them, for families, and you're trying to guide them to be symptom-free.
Yes, and you know, we talked about it. My patients have access to me 24/7, and I found that they actually don't abuse it. And we are friends, you know, they're not my, you know, every patient, no one calls me Dr. Lindley. Like at the most, they call me Dr. Kat, because that's who I am. You know, I'm part of the community, and we need to get back into community physicians and different professions. We need to grow roots. We need to start really living life together and creating relationships and connections. Because I think the reason we're going down this, you know, whirlwind experience we're all having is we have lost the touch with who we all are. And we are supposed to connect on a personal level. No one is better than anyone else. And like I said, I have weird ways of saying American sayings because, you know, I'm from Croatia. But there is a saying, I can bring a horse to water, I can make him drink. And
you can't make
that's
him
why
drink.
I feel that it starts with you and it ends with you. I'm here just to be the guide.
And, you know, I grew up in a beautiful rural community. And in a way, the doctor was so respected in a way, and they were available all of the time. But people, as you say, didn't abuse it. So maybe what I just wanted to do now is to move on to a connected discussion around the World Health Organization and this so-called pandemic treaty with Michael Alexander and James Roguski. And if both of you just want to come in and just explain about the World Health Organization and the treaty, and I suppose why it's an honor and a privilege to be connected with medical doctors, World Council for Health, around this discussion, and that vitamin D and ivermectin prevents it, is to make the connection that if there is prevention for the symptoms, then this whole pandemic treaty is really unnecessary. But Michael, if you want to maybe briefly introduce yourself again, and just as well, I know you're very taking a leadership role in the legal side of the World Council for Health.
Well, thanks, Dolores. Yes, I'm a lawyer trained in both Canada and the United States. Right now, I'm based in Toronto, Canada, and I represent doctors on both sides of the border who are fighting governments and their own colleges in their efforts to shut down people who want to express an alternative point of view about whether we have a pandemic, and if we do, how to deal with it. And so doctors everywhere are being punished for simply exercising the right to freedom of speech. and their right to discuss the science around this whole so-called crisis that we're in. And at the Law and Activism Committee, I act as co-chair, and we have been examining the WHO and its practices, its structure, how it's funded. And we regard it as a captured organization because of its funding model. I mean, one of the things that really shocked me when I first started looking into public health institutions last year was that they are all funded by the private sector in various ways. The CDC, the FDA, the NIH, the WHO. And the WHO is perhaps the worst example of that. Maybe it's the FDA, but I'll go with WHO for the moment. It receives over $1 billion a year from Bill Gates and one of his aligned organizations. And there are other public sector players, private sector players there as well. So you have an organization that's supposed to be acting in the public interest, but which is obviously based on the funding model, greatly influenced by private sector players. And we see this happening with the WHO's position about treatments, because of course it's on the side of the vaccines without any skepticism about that. And so it's essentially on the side of Big Pharma and its profit-making agenda. The new WHO treaty, which is just in the proposal stage now, recommends a number of different things. The first is that the WHO get a lot more money. It has a budget right now of about $7 billion a year. They'd like to get up to at least $14 billion, which means more contributions from the private sector and from government. They also want more power, which I'll speak to in a moment. And they want to establish biosurveillance centers around the globe. They've already established two. And one, I believe, is in Europe. Maybe both are. And so the biosurveillance aspect is very troubling because it's just going to be an extension of the surveillance state. And so we'll see a government and the private sector getting involved in the tracking of people's health. And that's, I think, troubling in itself. But the more power. WHO wants to sign an agreement with health ministers who will be deputized by governments around the world to establish what I call a world health dictatorship, which is to say, the next time that we face a public health problem that may have world dimensions, the WHO will dictate to the rest of the world whether we have a pandemic or not. It will also dictate how we deal with it in terms of treatment. And so that would be a change from an informal agreement where the WHO has a lot of influence to a formal agreement where governments around the world would delegate power to the WHO to handle these most essential aspects of public health. And so that is troubling if you don't trust the WHO as an institution.
Absolutely. And I think, and James, feel free to join us as well. That's excellent. So in a way, what Michael Alexander has just, you know, describing is that the World Health Organization is really funded by men, individual men and women, and who have an undue influence. And they are trying to allegedly instigate a treaty that could then curtail people's rights of freedom of travel or bodily integrity, James. But if you want to, I know you've been researching this and also writing articles on it. If you want to just introduce yourself and maybe as well how people can find you and support you.
Certainly. Anyone who knows me well knows that I am the unperturbable, calming influence in the room. Whenever someone is stressed out, it just, for whatever reason, maybe my adrenal glands are shot and I don't produce adrenaline, so I don't get nervous. But I'm actually here to get up on my soapbox and scream from, you know, the highest mountain and sound the alarm that time is of the essence, because there are things that are going on and the schedule. I'll just actually talk about the schedule, okay? At the end of May, the World Health Assembly, which are, many people don't realize that every country in the world, 194 members, get three delegates to go represent them or their country at the World Health Assembly, which will be happening in Geneva, Switzerland, May 22nd to the 28th this year. And you know, this is a rhetorical question. I don't expect anyone to answer it, but do you know who your three delegates are? Did you vote for them? Do you have any idea how to contact them and give them your input so that, you know, they can actually represent your wishes when they represent your country at this assembly and vote on, you know, the rights that you're about to lose in regards to health freedom in May? And so I was guided, I was very lucky to uncover a document which the powers that be probably maybe wish I didn't find. And that document is a list of amendments that the United States delegation to the World Health Assembly submitted just in time, 4 months in advance of the May assembly, so that these amendments could be considered in May. They snuck it in just a couple of days before. I suspect that, you know, deliberations are going along and, you know, people are wheeling and dealing to try to make deals so that these amendments, these changes to international law, which, you know, lawyers, many lawyers have never even heard of the international health regulations. And people don't realize that these regulations were passed in 2005 and they supersede at least the United States Constitution. And any amendments that might get enacted in May will become international law. And, you know, I'm going to venture to guess that most of your listeners have not heard a word about this.
So I think that's very interesting, James, and I know you were finding the foundational documents, but what I've been saying for the last, you know, all my life, really, I've been studying the law for decades, right? And just because people say something doesn't mean it's true, you know? So that's, I know that's very, but just to say that anything that has a regulation, you know, in the hierarchy of law is actually under the, you know, the foundational law of living men and women, and that we have all of our freedoms, and then we have governments and acts and regulations are below. So, you know, just to, that, as well as giving people the information, we also have to nuance it, that part of their, like Sung Tzu, you know, 2,500 years ago was saying that the art of war is to try and undermine your opponent before you even strike at them. So that they are putting out that these regulations supersede, you know, the nations and our, you know, majestic system of law in each of our nations. But of course, that may not be true, James, but fire ahead.
The color of law is something that people do not understand the concept of. Common law is unfortunately commonly forgotten. And to try to get out ahead of the narrative that the World Health Association is attempting to soon, you know, shove down our throats, I put together the People's Treaty as a response to the World Health Organization's Pandemic Treaty. So anybody can go to thepeoplestreaty.com, and it's just 10 unalienable rights that most people think can be taken away from them by an emergency power given to some government. And I'm here to say that these are your powers, but you lose them if you don't stand up for them. To rewind it a little bit to something that you said earlier, here in the United States, it may not have gotten much press around the world, but there was a moment in the past couple of weeks when a Supreme Court nominee was asked a question during her nomination proceedings, and she was asked to define a woman. And she stumbled and said she's not a biologist, so she couldn't define it. And I was screaming inside of my room, listening to this, going, wait a minute, you're a lawyer, or, you know, soon to be a Supreme Court justice. I couldn't believe that she was unable to toss it back to the other side of the court and say, well, I forget if, I think it was a senator. Well, dear senator, my job is to interpret the law, but you all have never gotten around to, in the law, defining what a woman is. If she had said to the senator, when you guys get around to defining in the law what a woman is, then I'll be able to tell you what the law says. Now, I said that story to bring forth some words that are in the same category that you've heard, you've probably used, you've heard many people use. Michael, if you know that I'm wrong on this, please tell me, because you've got a training in this. I can't find a legal definition for the word safe. I can't find a legal definition for the word effective. I can't find a legal definition for vaccine or pandemic or case. Okay. Now there are definitions for those words that are on the World Health Organization's website or the CDC's website or the FDA's website, but their definitions, it's kind of like Humpty Dumpty, right? You know, whatever I say the word means is what it means. Well, you know, you don't get to define legal terms. And so anytime I hear someone say it's safe and effective, you got to take this vaccine because we've got a pandemic and we've got so many cases, I know that they don't have any legal authority.
And that's an excellent point, James, because as I go through legislation in Canada, for instance, I find that a lot of the terms that are used in relation to the declaration of a public health emergency are not, terms of art in law. Words are used that have a very kind of hazy meaning and lack a technical specificity that you would expect for something as important as that. They're not carefully considered at all. And maybe that's on purpose so that they give governments the greatest leeway possible to define whatever it is they want to do. In the case of the WHO, we have the recent pronouncement, which of course you're very familiar with because you've written about this, but for the audience to mention that now the director general wants to reserve the right. Do I have it? Tedros formally called the director general? Yes.
I refer to him as the dictator general.
Yeah. Okay. So that's better. So the dictator general, Dr. Tedros, he wants to reserve the right to subjectively define when a pandemic exists. So if that is not dictatorship, I don't know what is. But around all the legislation that I have examined, whether it's on a domestic or international level, we find the use of language, which is very hoary, difficult to define. And I'm not for legalese. I'm not that kind of lawyer. I like things to be as plain as and clear for everybody, because we don't have a real, we don't have law if you can't understand it. There is a troubling lack of clarity in the definitions around pandemic, health crisis, emergency, treatment, et cetera. So you're pointing to ambiguities that are threatening to us as we go further down this path.
Can I just make a comment?
Go ahead, Jennifer. Yeah.
Just the involvement of the World Council for Health on these topics. In the Law and Activism Committee, where Michael has pointed out his co-chair, they've been conducting a lot of discussions around this topic and how we could get this kind of information out to countries around the world so they can determine how to react, interact, and work through all of this. And Kat, why don't you step in too and talk a little bit about some of this, because we've all been working together on this to try to figure out how we could compile this information. And certainly James has done an amazing job on his Substack to bring a lot of the documents together, and then his opinionating about it, which is interesting and also something people would like to go and read. But Kat, why don't you step in too and talk a little bit about what we've been doing in the World Council of Health and how we're trying to communicate information and what is coming up in the next week of interest that people may very much individually even like to engage with. This doesn't have to be alliances and groups and countries, it's actually individuals.
Yes, I think what's important to notice is actually James has done an amazing job to give us a little bit of an alarm sound, because what we thought initially is that we have until May of 2024, where this pandemic treaty that's being negotiated is going to be voted on. So everyone was like having some urgency and saying these are the things we need to do. And we actually done the Law and Activism Committee has done an amazing job coming with the first open letter to WHO that everyone should look at and download. We have translated in many languages. I actually, with one of our coalition partners from Croatia, helped translate it in Croatian. And then we have it, we have it in Italian, Spanish, all sorts of languages. So please go look at that source. But
WorldCouncilForHealth.org, is that right, Kat? Just in case.
Yes, ma'am, WorldCouncilForHealth.org, and it's Stop the Treaty Open Letter. So that's an amazing resource just to kind of get a little bit of information. So we're all kind of cruising along, coming up with these things. We're going to do this, we're going to do that. This is going to be our response. And then James comes in and say, hey, now May of 20 this year, they're bringing these international health regulations. So I think the most important thing for everyone, look at your own country's laws. James and I have looked into United States and what we can do as citizens of the United States, how we can respond to this, what we can do. Everyone has to see how they're going to ratify these IHRs, International Health Regulations, and the treaty later on. And there is a deadline this Monday and Tuesday that people can actually go on the website with WHO and put in their responses towards this. They can write the written response and they can do video. And I'll have James talk a little bit about this more in depth because he knows exact deadlines. But we all can
do something. Because I think, Kat, that's wonderful because part of the thing, which I'm delighted on this platform and show that we have through TNTradio.live is not just in a way to inform people what they're doing, because what we don't want to do is to create more fear. And James and Kat, if you want to go into detail on it, for example, for listeners in the United States or Canada specifically, is what specifically can they do to challenge, we'll say, this World Health Organization initiative, but also to extend it to, provide a basis around looking at the lawful system in their nations?
So I'll tell you what I've done. I'm a citizen of Texas. I'm a citizen of the United States. I've called my congressman and I send him a link to some of this information and said, do you know about this? And his staff is looking into it. And I write about it. I talk about it. I inform my colleagues. I inform the organizations I'm with. And I'm just saying, we are all citizens of this world. We need to let our voices be heard. Can we do something? I don't know. But it doesn't mean that we're going to sit back and do nothing. And James, if you don't mind, I would love for you to tell them exactly about the deadline this Monday and Tuesday with the written video statement and what they can do individually and as organizations.
Yes, the World Health Organization set up a website. It's very simple. It's inb.who.int. Stands for Intergovernmental Negotiating Body, World Health Organization International. And the deadline to submit, and they're very tricky. They said they would allow you to submit a 250 word statement, but it doesn't work that way. It's actually 1250 characters. So you have to be very concise, and I'm very verbose. But I took the People's Treaty and I looked at it. It was only about 500 words. I sliced and diced it and simplified it and got it down to 250. And that didn't work. I had to get it down to 180 words. So count on about 180 words. inb.who.int. And the deadline, Geneva time, is 5 p.m. on Wednesday. So you can translate that to your time zone. So the period is very short. Jennifer, I don't know if you want to expand on what we talked about earlier, but organizations that ask for public input oftentimes just do that as a, it's a ruse, okay? And but that's still, say what you want to say, and then take that process of you saying what you want to say and record yourself doing that and, put out a video, put it on Telegram or Instagram or, any social media and spread the word. It's like they have claimed that they will post all of everyone's statements on that same website in a public archive So, you know, get your words in there. I've had trouble. I still haven't had a chance to get them to accept my submission. There's some kind of glitch, you know, which maybe it's accidental computer programming, but the deadline is 5 p.m. Wednesday, Geneva time. So very early in the morning for me here in California. Tell all your friends.
James, can you just repeat the how they go with the access, the website they go to?
It's inb.who.int. Then you click on a link and, you know, follow the instructions and you get to a place where you could submit your written declaration, probably about 180 words.
Thank you.
And Dolores, you know how I feel. The power is in people, right? So everyone has to do something. You know, at the end of the day, will we succeed? Hey, I'm full of hope, and I hope we do. But even if we don't, we made our voices heard, and it's very important for everyone to participate in this process. And like James said, yes, it could be just a rouse for them to say we've done this public hearing, but it's important.
Absolutely.
So, and I think as well, Kat, I think we can move on as well. But James, if you want to jump in, but Kat, if you want to come back as well,
just to describe,
I suppose, as well, Kat, after James jumps in, around what you were mentioning around vaccinations, because a lot of what they're doing is pushing the so-called vaccine passports and infringing on our freedom of travel. But James, you wanted to...
One last thing on this topic, yes. In addition to encouraging everyone to put in their, you know, submission to the WHO, I challenge everyone here, all my new friends here, I challenge everyone in the world, find who the three delegates are that are supposed to be representing your country to the World Health Assembly. Find out who they are, get their contact information. You know, find me on my Substack through thepeoplestreaty.com. And my next article is going to be, how do we track our representatives down? How can you even begin to say that this is a democratic body that represents the people when none of us really know who our representatives are? That's my challenge to the world right now.
And I think I'm very happy as well.
Oh, sorry.
If Michael wants to jump in, but I think that the learning for this as well is that, you know, if you look at the legal definition or legalese, right, their language, there is a difference between living men and women, boys and girls, and citizens. And actually, on the hierarchy of importance, a citizen is defined as a slave for people who don't know who they are. So the thing is, the whole, you know, the revelation of this is the difference between the law that applies to men and women that can be harmed and have adverse events, and then this legal fiction, you know, the citizen, the non-entity that actually cannot be harmed because they're only a corporation. And in a way, the law in each of our nations applies to men and women, as does our adverse events. And I think this, you know, the World Health Organization applying the treaty as a regulation, which is way below, it's like what the councils would do, and actually has no standing in law. It may take years for this to filter through, but I think that is partly what the World Council for Health can do, is to give that message out that a regulation doesn't actually impact us in our daily lives. But Michael, just jump in there.
Well, I just wanted to ask James if he could give us a reference to the international health regulations for those who want to do some of their own research, the reference to your article, and whether we can actually look up these IHRs on the internet.
The IHRs are interesting. When you do a search for international health regulations, the first thing that you find gives you a busted link on the World Health Organization's website, which is, you know, intriguing. You can find it just with a simple search. My Substack is just my name, James Roguski, roguski.substack.com. The easiest thing to remember is thepeoplestreaty.com. And you'll find it all there. And, you know, my phone number is right there. And I'm going to shock everybody here. I'll give you my phone number right now. It's 310-619-3055. If anyone listening is interested, and if that's in the United States, so you have to do the appropriate codes. But call me anytime, 310-619-3055. And I'll give you my personal rendition of the international health regulations. We should know what they are. I agree with you absolutely, Dolores. You know, the purpose for me putting together the People's Treaty is that if someone is going to pretend to craft a law in my name, I'm darn well going to make sure that my rights are going to be protected. So the first 10 articles in any treaty that anybody might want to craft in my name is going to be like a health-related bill of rights. Thou will not step on these inalienable rights. So I want to educate people what their rights are. And you know, that will just make any treaty to offend those rights crumble if enough people know that they have the power.
The reason, Dolores, this is all important is because if this treaty, these amendments, these IHRs are passed, what happens is WHO can actually come in and have a global response to any pandemic in the future we have. And if you go back to the actually WHO constitution, you can find different articles. One of the articles that's very, very alarming, it's these articles 19, 20, and 21. And I believe it is 21. Everyone can go look it up. I urge you to do your own research. I'm all about you doing the work. I can give you ways to look at it. But 21 would allow them to really determine our response. If there's new vaccines, if there's new treatments, how do we name the diseases? They can change more definitions. They can tell us which therapeutics to use. They can pretty much create this one health, one world that Dr. Tedros has said in January in his speech at the assembly at World Health Organization. I believe we all feel that every human is a sovereign entity. And we do have
you know,
a
part
voice
of
in our
what's
health.
Going on is around vaccines, Kat, and I think you know significant amounts as a medical doctor around vaccines.
Well, all I can tell you is that this whole response we had doesn't make any sense, right? It's one size fit all, and let's vaccinate the rest of the world. And, you know, the countries are kind of opening up and everyone's like, oh, we don't have to do it. But if you really look at the narrative, we might have opened up in certain places, but we keep on asking for more boosters, boosters, and boosters. And even go back to EU. EU has just passed something that starting in June, they have a venue to mandate the vaccines again in their participating countries. And, you know, after EU, UK is going to come into play. United States is going to come into play. Canada is going to come into play. And all this is going to go forward and forward and forward. And how many boosters are we going to have? Where are we going to stop? Like, is it 5? Is it 10? Is it 15? I don't know. It's like at some point we have to say this is not an answer. And you and I both know what the answer is. The answer is early treatment and prevention. If you just take some vitamins and a healthy diet and take care of your body, you might not get the illness. If you do get the illness, you find a physician who's going to treat you and do what they're supposed to do. My job is to help. I cannot stand by and watch someone suffer and say, well, you know what, wait at home until you get short of breath. And then if you're short of breath, go to the hospital and maybe, you know, we'll try this, we'll try that. There are so many studies. You know, we both have spoken with different physicians. I work with all of these amazing doctors around me, and we speak at these events. We have one today in Houston, actually. It's called Global COVID Summit in Houston today. Early treatment works. We have shown it works. So let us do our job. And, you know, we have spoken about the therapeutics, and even Jennifer can jump in at this point. There's an amazing study that Dr. Lucy Kerr just did in Brazil. Amazing study that showed that ivermectin does work. They cannot deny it as much as they want to. Go ahead, Jennifer, please.
I would love to talk about that because I participated in writing the paper and it's amazing. It's, that's my information here. So I tell you exactly what happened. Or maybe
Is that ivermectin prophylaxis used for COVID-19, a citywide prospective observational study of 220,000 subjects?
Yes, that's the study. And in this study, with regular use of ivermectin, which was designated as, and it was just a low dose of ivermectin, 0.2 milligrams per kilogram, taking it 2 days, consecutive days, every 15 days. The results were phenomenal. Those that were taking it as regular users, and those were designated people that followed the program, there was 100% reduction in hospitalization, 100%. And there was a 90% reduction in mortality rate. And for risk of dying, it was 86% decrease. And
that's phenomenal.
For females, there was zero mortality rate. I mean, I could go on and on. It was phenomenal, the study. And we have another paper that we're actually working on that's going to come out shortly that is going to go into more of the data study. And it's, and we're going to be putting that out shortly so that it goes into specificities. Of course, we're getting a lot of pushback from this. There's been talks that have been done and, well-known scientists going on videos and talking. The biggest pushback we got came right after, just recently, actually, about two things happened. One was regarding our conflicts of interest. And there was a big production about the fact that we said that none of the authors had a conflict of interest. And they pointed out a conflict of interest is anybody that's affiliated with an organization that's out to help and support people with early treatments, specifically ivermectin. And so they said, for instance, I had a huge conflict of interest because I'm a founder of the Canadian COVID Care Alliance and I'm a founder of the World Council for Health, and that Pierre Corey and also Flavio had conflicts of interest because they're part of the FLCCC, and Dr. Corey has a telehealth program that he'd started, and actually he started it after the paper was published. But all doctors are doing telehealth medicine. So, and he's not getting paid. He's just providing prescriptions and he's doing medical care for his patients. So I think from what I can see, the only person that got paid that had a conflict of interest is the person that was assigned to do this video and was assigned.
Exactly. And I suppose this is part of the kind of reputational damage that they want to do to smear people that are signing up. But James, do you have a comment on this? Yeah.
Well, I've, absolutely everything Jennifer said. With all of the research that I've done, with all of the reports and the papers and the commissions and all, just the chatter amongst the intelligentsia that surrounds the World Health Organization, none of these people who are deciding what the law is going to be have ever treated anybody for COVID. Doctors are not involved in the conversations that determine how health is going to be, legally constructed. And that's the biggest problem. And so part of what I've been trying to do is reach out to, folks like you all and connect to the doctors who are awake and are aware and say, the problem is that the clinical doctors who are saving lives because they're thinking for themselves are not being heard in these negotiations. And part of that is at the fault of the doctors who have to just become aware that this treaty process and these amendments are going on. And you don't have to speak to the WHO, you speak to the process by which the doctors are not being heard. And my opinion, and I'd love to talk to Michael about this, I don't know if it's a possible thing, but the bureaucrats are practicing medicine without a license. And they're trying to make laws even stronger. And it's like, let doctors be doctors. There's a million, opinions amongst doctors, but, they collaborate, they work together, they want to help their patients. And their experience in the real world is being hindered by this intelligentsia that surrounds all of these bureaucracies that are filled with lobbyists and companies and lots of money. And we need to be able to crack into that discussion, because the people who know what the heck they're doing are not in the discussion.
Well, I like to quote the the oracle from the Matrix, who says, asks rhetorically, "What do men with power want? More power." And this is true for bureaucrats. These public health bureaucrats share something in common with bureaucrats all across the administrative state, which is that the government gives them leeway to actually legislate for the people. And this is a crisis in all nations where there's some semblance of democracy. And so this is even worse in the case of public health bureaucrats. In fact, I've recently made a study of Health Canada, which is our federal public health agency, and I can't really figure out how it works. I finally found one person who understands it a little bit, and I've begun to unlock the mystery that's inside a riddle, inside an enigma. But there's a positive attempt to obscure how these health bureaucrats actually make decisions. But it's a phenomenon, and it's undemocratic, and we have to battle it because it occurs behind closed doors. I just want to mention, too, I did a quick Google search on Canada's delegates to next World Health Assembly, and it's going to be the health minister and other unnamed people. But the most important part of our delegation is a youth representative. This is well publicized across all forums, and you can have a discussion with her through. So anyway, we've got a youth representative, so it's all good.
I think that's very useful, Michael. But I suppose what's happening in Ireland, and I know in Canada and in Australia, that what people are actually now fundamentally looking at is, well, what is the structure? Like I think what James was saying, and what the World Council for Health and you are all investigating, what is the structure of the World Health Organization? What is its basis in law? And how can it claim to do things? Because, you know, you have the World Council for Health, we have the World Freedom Alliance. We could all decide to make health treaties, you know, and we could just have all of us are international organizations with nearly every country in the world between us. We could have our own treaty around health integrity, bodily integrity, and that doctors and people in the law are themselves liable if they bring in any laws that infringe on the inalienable laws, which is freedom of speech and bodily integrity. James, do you want to jump in there?
I do. If you build it, they will come. And in the byline on all of my articles on Substack, my goal is, I see these horrible structures crumbling. People are starting to witness that it's a mess. I've worked in construction, and there are some homes that are beautiful and you renovate them. They might have some problems, but you fix up, your home's beautiful. But sometimes you just got to, tear it down and start over, but you can't tear it down and start over because then you're homeless. And so I'll throw it to Jennifer and Kat and Michael. We need to hurry up and build the replacement. And that's what I'm working to do.
And the one thing that was wonderful. I love how you described that. And that is so true. Kat, please go ahead.
No, I was going to say the reason we're all doing this is James touched on something very important. You have bureaucrats making health decisions for the world. And, we have actually come together in many organizations. And one of the ones I'm part of is globalcovidsummit.org. We have our declaration. And the declaration says exactly what James said. Let doctor be doctors. Because we are going towards this future that I'm not sure it's really sustainable. You guys in UK are about to approve vaccines, children 5 to 11, I believe is the age. And today at this summit in Houston, I'm going to talk about children. I'm going to talk how it affected them. Them wearing this mask has affected their speech patterns. It has affected their emotional growth because they need to see the emotion behind words. If you say stop with a certain tone of voice, they need to see how, if you smiled behind the stop or if you frowned, so they can associate the emotional intelligence behind the words. So we've taken that away from them. The IQs have dropped in children. And also another thing that's very important, if children get the COVID, which they do because it's a virus, it's all around us, it's endemic at this point, They create this immunity that works really, really well. So why would you want to vaccinate a child against the disease that they are creating immunity against and give them this experimental injection, whatever it is, and create an environment where they could develop myocarditis? Chest pain and shortness of breath is not normal in a child. No matter how many times they say it's mild, it's not normal in a child. And if one of my children developed chest pain and shortness of breath, I would freak out even as a doctor, because that's my child. And for these physicians and other people to say, oh, it's just mild, they'll get over it, I'm really sorry, but I don't agree with that.
Yeah, and okay. I think part of the whole thing is, you know, the revelation and the sadness in a way is that parents will eventually realize that there was no need for the masks for anyone, but including for children. And that it's actually the parents of these boys and girls, it's their responsibility to look after them and to educate themselves. And in a way, people use the phrase stand in their power. But it is true that if you know who you are, you would say, no, my child needs oxygen, you know?
Yeah. And Doris, yes. I just testified in the Australian Senate, and one of the senators asked me after I gave exactly this type of a conversation. We had a conversation and they asked me, do you think this is child abuse? And no one has ever asked me that question, you know. So I kind of paused for a moment. I looked at him in the eyes and I said to him, yes, it is. And I really, in that moment, I truly felt it, because to put a mask on a child, you know, and to make them wear it the whole time they're in school, where they're trying to speak, interact with their friends, we are creating this whole generation that's going to have scars. And I think it's going to be hard for them to recover. And as parents and as physicians, we really need to, we need to be their advocates and their voice.
Yes, I'm a total agreement. And, you know, the fact that they've actually changed the developmental parameters for children now too, and said that they don't expect your child to have their speech developed for, and they've pushed it ahead. Kat, is it not a year that they've pushed it ahead, the developmental parameters?
Yeah, they keep on changing that timeline, because what they're discovering is that we are creating a whole generation that's behind, a lot more behind than they should be.
It's really sad how they, and the advertising and the messaging early on put the children out as the protectors and the ones that are going to safeguard the world. And they put the children forward. Since when do we put our children out to save our parents and our grandparents? That's our role as parents and grandparents, to protect our children. When I see kids coming into my practice, they look at their parent, because of course, coming into the operatory, they have, you know, they have to take their mask off. I can't look at their teeth without them doing that. And so often the children and the parents, you can see them struggling too. And they're going, sweetie, you know, it's okay. And I'll say, honey, you can take your mask off. You're safe in here to do that. And they look at their parent and they're very scared. And I've had 15 and 16 year olds say to me, I feel like I've had my life stolen from me. I'm not able to live my life. And, you know, I speak very positively to them. There's always a silver lining to every cloud. And I try to
help
them.
But I think, you know, part of the thing is as well that it will be a learning, right, for them and for generations to come, to look back and say, how did we end up in the years 2020 to 2022? And it has been, you know, decades of planning. And maybe just in finishing off, we might say that I was reading again Alexander Solzhenitsyn, you know, and it just, one of his things is that one word of the truth shall outweigh the whole world, right? So part of what they want to do in the censorship is for parents and for families not to hear this information. But once they do, the whole thing will be shattered and exposed, and they will, you know, realize that what has been done to children and the elderly or whatever was entirely unnecessary. But maybe I just wanted to thank everybody on the call in the last minute. So Dr. Jennifer Hibbert and Dr. Kat Lindley and the lawyer Michael Alexander, and you can find and follow all of them on the World Council for Health. And James, if you just want to give some of your web pages before we go.
You know, call me 310-619-3055. And I just want everyone to learn what their rights are and defend them. So go to thepeoplestreaty.com.
Wonderful. And thank you, everyone. And you can find me, because I am very much censored, on custodian.com and profdolorescahill.com. And of course, World Freedom Alliance and World Doctors Alliance. So thank you, everyone. And thank you also to TNT Radio.live.